I think that maybe an interesting series might be, and I'm just playing this as it goes along, Carol, would be to talk about the concept of the ombudsman today, and then tell you a little bit about what a prison is like, because that's kind of fun. Well, it's not fun at all. In fact, it's interesting. And you might want to ask some questions if you've not been associated with a prison or criminal justice, some of the things about drugs and sex offenders and things like that that you read in the paper. Because the public, by and large, doesn't know very much about criminal justice or corrections. You read about it in the paper, but basically our society, from the time that this whole business began, has been trying to bury the whole thing out in the countryside. That's where all our prisons are located. The move now is to bring all those people that are inside prisons or are inside correctional institutions into the community. And on Wednesday, I'd like to talk about that. I have a little slide and sound thing that was pretty professionally done by another Lutheran that's a friend of Johann, Pat McManus, and he said, say hello, I just remembered that. And he did that on a government grant. It was a neat little thing done with a commentator from WCCO in Minneapolis doing the narration, Dave Moore. How many of you are from Minneapolis or from Minnesota, by the way? Okay, well then you've been reading about the prison system in the paper. I got a sign.
I think I should put it on the, I'm going to say it. This is not just for Minnesota.
Oh, it isn't. No, it's for the whole thing. But
and I think they got sort of the idea that only where you've got Scandinavians can they have.
But the I was assigned in January to work in the Department of Corrections. In Minnesota, they have a program called LEAP, where they call that means Loaned Executive Action Program. Well, all the major firms have lend executives to the governor, and then he assigns them out to various departments to try to help them improve what they're doing. And I kind of came in the back door. I was involved in corrections before through a couple of associations that I had, and my boss was on a commission that helped set up the ombudsman in the Department of Corrections. And so one day he came to me in late December and said, how would you like to take 6 months off? And that always appeals to someone when they say 6 months off. But then he said, you're going to have to do something. And if you'd like to do that, why would you like to work in the Department of Corrections? And I said, that sounded like a good idea because I was interested in that. And he said, setting up an ombudsman. And then I knew he had something up his sleeve because he's been trying to get an ombudsman started in our company for a long time. And I knew that was in the back of his mind. And I just finished the tour at the end of June, and now I'm in the process of trying to set one up within Control Data. And it worked so well, and the experience was so good, that now I'm going to try to set one up of our own. Which is not unique, because many companies have tried it out, are beginning to try it out. Xerox has got a lot of publicity about trying it. But anyway, the ombudsman idea is one that started in Scandinavia, and it's still going very, very strong. It's been extremely successful there. I thought it would be kind of interesting to find out what people thought or think an ombudsman does. I know that some of you have been experienced with the ombudsman directly, like you've been at least to some extent in Norway, haven't you, Ms. Vera?
Not,
how do you say ombudsman in Norway?
Ombudsman.
Almost everyone has a hard time pronouncing it. They started out, my boss still can't say it right. He's been dealing with it for a year, and he says, ombudsman or something like that. I think there's an advantage to that, because everybody at least thinks about the word. It's very hard to say. But there are some in Oregon, and in Iowa, and Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and they're all doing different things. They're trying the idea out for a lot of different purposes. And now they're talking about a federal ombudsman. Have you heard about that? The federal ombudsman, especially after the Watergate, that's one of the solutions they're talking about to prevent something like that from happening again. So, we were talking earlier, what do you think an ombudsman does? What is your concept of an ombudsman? Okay. That's
well,
what you get for coming up and talking to me.
He's a mediator.
Mm-hmm.
A go-between.
He's a go-between, right. Mediation is a beautiful word to describe what an ombudsman does. What else do you think an ombudsman does? Anybody have an idea?
It's a combination between a priest and a prosecutor.
Yeah. That's a good stereotype. And in some places he does that. Yeah, he does. Does that. You raising your hand or throwing something in the fire? Oh, it's time flies. Anybody else have any idea what an ombudsman does?
Can he be a buffer?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he can be.
She?
Right. We have an affirmative action program in our company to hire women, you know, discriminate in their favor. And we're thinking seriously about hiring a woman for the job. And there are a lot of good women mediators that come out of the federal mediation system. despite all the stereotypes, they're very good mediators. They do just as well, if not better than men. We'll have to talk about that one of your sessions. Yeah. No, it's hard to describe what an ombudsman does, because he deals with problems that people have that they can't get solved through the regular institutional procedures. And that's basically it. If someone comes to an ombudsman with a grievance, and they're very upset about something, you know, like with the government, and you feel powerless, and usually you are, because you've gone through the normal channels, and normally there isn't a very good grievance procedure. If you get mad at the income tax business, or if you get mad at the welfare, I don't know if any of you have tried to tackle the welfare system. We have. That's something else again. We're going to talk a little bit about that on Wednesday night. But it's very difficult if you have a problem that you can't get it solved. An ombudsman is simply, as it's grown up in the Scandinavian countries, somebody who hears a grievance, then goes and investigates it, and makes a finding. He'll investigate, he'll talk to both parties, has to be impartial. And then he comes out, and in Sweden, for instance, they published the results. Or in Denmark, one of the Scandinavian countries, are really brutal about it, I think. They get a complaint, and they publish the complaint in the paper. And if you write in and say, I think that a public official thinks he did something really bad, they publish that right away in the paper. And that causes people to be a little bit cautious in their dealings with people, because they know it may show up in the paper. Then they have a hearing, and they publish the results of that. Now, in this country, that doesn't work too well in our democratic process. And the politicians don't like that at all. And I doubt that many politicians would buy that here. And so we have sort of evolved different kinds of systems. And if you're mad at somebody else in the government, or I keep saying the government because that's where I think they're coming, you come to an ombudsman, and you make your complaint, and he or she will interview you very carefully, and then go investigate, talk to the person that you're angry at, and then come back and talk to you again, and try to get the two parties together. The whole idea is to get the thing solved at the lowest possible level. About 80% of the cases are just plain, you didn't understand her, and the communication flow has to take place. And usually somebody's very angry, or quite angry, and so it's a tough role to play. You get in between two people that are angry, and they're not hearing each other. And most of the time they don't even have a grievance. There's nothing wrong, except that they just kind of insulted each other by some behavior that has nothing to do with what they're arguing about. And so there's an awful lot of just mediation and conciliation involved in that. Now, there are lots of different kinds of ombudsmen. There could be. There could be, like there is in Iowa, where the state employees, and I believe this is the way it is, have an ombudsman to come to when they want to complain about something their boss did, or the company did, or the state did. That's the kind of thing I'm setting up now. Then there are a lot that are becoming very popular, or they're thinking about them. And they're not, I don't know of any of these yet, but they're consumer ombudsmen, where if you don't like something that somebody did, and this is mostly, again, in terms of the government, you can come to them with a grievance. Now, in the area of consumer affairs, I guess some states have. We have some kind of ombudsman in Minnesota, in some certain areas. But they're not truly designated at that. And then there are some things like what I've been doing, which is directly and just in a narrow band dealing with inmates within prison, and then people that are on parole. And usually when I say that, and if I'm talking to anybody about it, something will click in their mind, and they say, well, when someone goes to prison, you know, they don't really have any rights. That's normally what happens first in your mind. And I didn't understand the rights of inmates either, and there's a strong movement about that, to do something about that. But in order to understand what an ombudsman does, first of all, do you have any more comments or questions about an ombudsman? What?
But who hires an ombudsman?
That's a tough one. I guess the only thing I can talk about is from experience. In Minnesota, a group of citizens got this idea, and they went to the governor, and they said to him, you ought to do this, and they got him sold on it. And some of them came out of the law school, some of them came out of business. It was kind of a combination of law and business. And so then the governor said, okay, and he went and found some crime commission, LEAA funds they call them, law enforcement assistance something or other funds, and decided to set a program up for 12 months. And it started a year ago about now. The selection was a difficult process. They left it up to this group of citizens. They made them the Ombudsman Commission, and they had to go out in the community and find someone that could relate and have credibility. And that's a tough thing with an ombudsman, credibility. So they scoured the community, and they found a black man named T. Williams, who had been running a settlement house up in North Minneapolis. Now, one of the important things about picking someone that's black is that a large percentage of the population in prison is black. They're very black and poor. That's usually the characteristic. If you're not black and poor, you're white and poor. And very few people are anything else but that in prison. So it has to be somebody that can relate to them, and yet it has to be someone who can relate to the establishment. Now that's tough. It's hard to find somebody that can walk that fence. But they picked this guy who did it. When I found out about it, I wasn't very happy about the selection because he and I had been having some real hard arguments about things in the daycare end of the business. Control Data does some things in daycare too. And he and I had run into some real budget fights, and we were going like this all the time. And I thought, gee, this is a hard-headed guy. He can't conciliate anything. I don't know why they picked him. And then my boss asked me if I wanted to work for him for 6 months, and I said, I better go over and talk to him before I decide to work for him. Because I didn't think they'd made a very good selection. But I found out that he was an outstanding selection because he's a great mediator. He just wasn't in the mood to mediate with me because I was trying to take some money away from him, and he was trying to take some money away from me, and you don't mediate a situation like that very easily. But he's a great selection. And then he selected all the rest of the people. He had to do it very rapidly. He went on board in January, and he didn't have time to set up any systems. He just said, I'm here, and sent out brochures to all the inmates and all the institutions, and the grievances just came poof like that. You know, he had a caseload of over 100 within a week. And they're very surprised because we didn't think that inmates would complain like that. But we found out that the senators and the representatives were getting complaints all over the place. And they had been waiting for him to come, and they dumped all their mail on him. Because it's amazing how many complaints there are about prisoners. I think for the number of people involved, there are about 2,000 inmates in the corrections institutions in Minnesota. Probably 50% of them are complaining half of the time. It's a large number of complaints. Maybe not that high, but he decided he better get somebody else quick. So he hired a man, this is the layman, the Missouri Lutheran Layman Center preacher. He hired him to be his deputy, and he figured they could handle it. Well, within another month, the two of them had more than they could handle. Then they realized that in the reformatory for younger men, there's a large proportion of Indians, and there also are some Indians in the prison. So they decided to hire an Indian, who, as you said, Carol, later on turned out to be Lutheran too, but we didn't know this. We discovered this about 4 or 5 months later. And so that he could handle a lot of the problems up at St. Cloud, where they have the younger adult offenders. And then we hired a woman as an ombudsman. We thought we were going to have her for the female institution. We have a very small number of women in prison. I think there are less than 50 in Minnesota, but we thought she should handle that. Turns out that she was so good at dealing with men that she never goes out to the women's reformatory once in a while. But they wouldn't talk to her. They talked to some of the guys, but they wouldn't talk to her. The sex offenders would talk to her, but they wouldn't talk to us. And we started learning patterns of things, and that's a very important thing because you have a lot of different kinds of clients inside of a prison or anywhere else. Her name is Carol Safer. You might know her. She's been around in court systems and things for a long time. She's been mostly a volunteer. Her husband's a art professor at the university. And she doesn't show up in the paper. She never gets tear gassed. They tend not to tear gas women. I forgot to tell you, but when I went into the system, everything was going rather smoothly. And for the 6 months I was there, they had the most disruptive 6 months that they've ever had in the history of the prison system. And then when I left, everything settled down again. And I've been trying to figure out just what went on, because I really wasn't bothering anybody. I just kind of floated in and out of situations. But they really have had, those of you that live in Minnesota know that they've had a very, very disruptive period. They've had more tear gassings, for instance, inside the prison than they've had all the rest of the time combined. But the year before, leading up to that, they had a lot of escapes, a lot of very dramatic things. One of the first things the ombudsman got caught up in was three inmates had escaped, and they were caught and brought back. And these are pretty tough guys. They were all in for murder of one sort or another. And they were very upset about what had happened to them when they came back. And so they grabbed the guard and held him hostage, and they were going to cut his throat. And they said they would talk to the ombudsman and the commissioner of corrections. And so the two of them went back there, and the ombudsman did most of the talking, and he talked them out of the prison, out of the guard. Gave them the guard, promised to try to help them out, and let them go. And there were quite a few situations like that where the ombudsman could intervene as a third party in some really, really violent situations. Now, I don't see that as something that you might use out in public. You know, we don't run into those kinds of things. Well, maybe we do. Some people get awfully mad at public officials, but I don't know if they ever get to the point where they threaten to kidnap them or something like that. But inside of a prison, that can happen quite often. So we found ourselves playing the roles of mediators in some very tight situations. Some more questions about ombudsman. I keep wandering into the prison, but you know, the concept of it is something.
Well, it's been difficult to answer my question. There really isn't any, and the ombudsman doesn't have to feel any kind of, the funds are coming from an anonymous enough source so that he there's no problem of where his,
oh, I see what you mean. Yes, that's absolutely important. Or it was, to me, it was the most important thing at first. If the ombudsman reports to the guy he's criticizing, he's not going to be very useful unless he has an outside avenue.
Right.
That's what's unique about Minnesota's program, as far as I know. He's criticizing, or I shouldn't say that. He's an ombudsman within the Department of Corrections, but he reports to the governor, does not report to the Commissioner of Corrections. So if he starts mediating something down low and he keeps building it up, the next to the last stage is with the third to the last stage is with the Commissioner of Corrections. If they can't solve it, they go to the governor. And if they can't solve it, then he goes to the press if he wants to. We worked out the legislation. I helped write the legislation and get it passed the legislature. And that was one thing that was very interesting. We were a little fearful of even putting anything about the press in there. The legislators put that in. And they said, well, the governor can't solve it, take it out to the people, let them see what they can do. But the present guy said he'd never do that. You know, if you go to the governor twice, you used up all your cards and the game's over, he feels. And it might be. So the emphasis is really on how well the guy can solve the problem at the first level down. If you have to take everything on up to the top, then they're solving it and you're not doing your job, really, is what it wants to. But that's very important. He does have to have freedom. If he's got political ties of some sort or another, then you know he's going to be in trouble from the start because people won't believe his veracity. It's hard enough to in a prison, for instance, to get the guards and the inmates to think that you're fair, because the ombudsman is supposed to listen to the complaints of the guards as well as the inmates. In fact, just before we left, we had a guard come and complain to us about an inmate's behavior, and we really thought that was a milestone because that had never happened before. And we investigated and found out the inmate was wrong and made him go apologize to the guard. And everybody kind of cheered. That was the first. You know, things are really maturing when you can do that. That's a very, very important concept.
Is the ombudsman in a position, something like the grand jury, that where they criticize the grand jury because it has no power?
Yes, he has no power. Now, that's not true in some of the Scandinavian countries. He can direct, I think it's in Sweden. Yeah, he can direct officials to do things. He can step in and say, you straighten that out. In our process, politically, it'd be impossible to get a bill like that through right now. Maybe I'm cynical, but I watched that process, and we had a very liberal legislature this time. And it's a tough one. Maybe someday he'll get to that. And I'm not so sure that's right. I don't know if that's the way it ought to be. He really is a force of public opinion, a mediator, and we could argue about that for a long time. And when we have our first international ombudsman conference, I'm sure that's about what we'll talk about most of the time.
Would depend so much on the person holding the office and not just the officer. That'd be my problem if I were a legislature. Listen, to the right guy would be terrific and the wrong guy would be a tyrant.
Right. And then that's another problem. That's the other side. How do you remove an ombudsman? It's like a Supreme Court justice in some countries. In our state, the ombudsman serves at the pleasure of the governor. And if he doesn't like him, out he goes. Now, that makes it a little difficult for him to complain about the governor in the press.
Mm-hmm.
It might be his last statement as an ombudsman in the press, you know. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned the consumer ombudsman. Would you say that Ralph Nader was a type of ombudsman?
Yeah, he's a highly sophisticated ombudsman in a way. He has a tremendously in-depth research staff. He's awfully biased in one direction. It'd be very difficult for him to be, you gotta really, there are always two sides to every issue. Almost always is. I haven't seen an issue yet where there isn't. And so when you go in, you have to come to some sort of solution that favors both sides to some degree. Mm-hmm. You know, this guy may be 90% wrong and this guy 10% wrong, so the solution's gotta be 90% sort of. Nader is out to, really to get somebody. One of our ombudsmen has done that. He's been out to get people, and he's losing ground fast.
That's the one with the mental hospital?
No, I mean, we're in the corrections ombudsman staff. It's a real problem. He's really out to get, he's a new guy, and we have some new staff now since I left. And he's having a terrible time because he's just in there and he's going to, get the guards. He's going to get them all fired. That's not his job. Somebody else has got to do that if that's necessary, and that's not for him to decide either, really. Yes?
Well, from that, then you're not looking toward the type of reform that only to keep things smooth with the structure that you've
got. Yes. Just let me answer that for a second and what the objectives really are. At first, they were, we felt that the people that set the program up felt that an ombudsman, by demonstrating to inmates in a prison that society is just, has some justice within a prison, will then become more likely to accept the rules of society and become better citizens when they get out. Well, that's a bunch of hogwash. That doesn't work at all, but it sounds good. And it sold the program, it got a lot of money. But the ombudsman's function really is two things. One, to ensure, just plain ensure that prisoners' rights are upheld for that reason, that there is some justice within a prison and within parole. And the second one is to watch the policies and procedures, to watch his experience, and then recommend changes to the rules and rights. I spent about half my time on prisoners' rights, trying to figure out what they were, setting up systems to explain it to people and make sure everybody understood it. Yes, sir?
Now, you can't answer the question. I've always thought of the role of an ombudsman as more of an advocate rather than a mediator.
Yes.
And to cut through the red tape.
And then that's the Scandinavian style. You see, he really is, even though he's supposed to be impartial, he is, I believe, and I've just read about it. I don't know.
The name means Om is around, Buddha is messenger, man is carrying the message. The man who gets the message around the obstruction. An ombudsman is one who gets around the obstruction.
Yes.
To where something can happen. Exactly what the name is.
And he can't very well help but be known as an advocate because he's usually set up because some body of people are not getting their rights. The legislature or whoever it is wouldn't go to all the trouble and money to set one up if they didn't feel somebody was not getting a fair shake. So we caught ourselves talking about being advocates all the time, but we quit doing that because we wanted to get the staff involved with us too. And after we quit doing that about 2 months, then they came to us with complaints. We've had a healthy number of complaints from the staff. I was particularly interested in that because I'm interested in getting people in business to do this, and I wanted to get some experience with staff, and I wasn't getting any, except that they were kind of mad at us all the time.
I don't know, like Ken Greenfield at Anoka has had his gripes on the ombudsman because he always runs the media. He runs the media immediately. He does not, he doesn't take the matter up. It's like he wants to get some publicity, but he wants to be on the right side of the public.
Yeah.
I mean, and he advocated one kind of a program, an open-ended, no discipline, low kind of, supervision deal. Then a guy gets out and kills and rapes a gal, and then he's on the other side yelling.
Yeah.
So he wants it, and tends to the guy who refuses to be a man. He won't stand up for one side or the other. He can't have both ways.
It's hard to separate.
He's
a physician up there.
Yeah,
no,
but I'm there. The language man up there. He's gotten the media twice. But when something happens, it's bad, then he wants to be on the opposite side. It wasn't supervision. Then somebody says he's been under too much supervision, he was busting the floor by and take away. And like I said, you can't have it both ways. You've got to stand one side or the other of the problem.
There are a couple of issues. One, and they get touted. One is the ombudsman, just to make sure that people are being treated properly, fairly in terms of the rules as they exist. And then the other one is, in terms of correction, is correcting the situation. And then correcting the person, the individual within an institution. And those two things have to be dealt with separately, and it's almost impossible to do that. And I have a hard time because I'm always drifting off into the corrections end of the business, which is extremely difficult. That's almost an impossible situation right now. It's frustrating, so I don't know, I must like to frustrate myself because I have to wander off in there. We'll talk more about that on Friday. I'd like to really, really hit that. Another reason I was I'm carrying on several conversations with myself, but another thing I'd like to talk about on Friday is the criminal justice system, because it's a microcosm of society in general. When you go into a prison or into the court system or anything else, you can see things much more clearly that happen within there that really reflect what happened in society. They have systems just like we do outside. They have their own jails. They have their own juries. They have formal juries. They have vigilantes. Vigilantes are very effective. If the institution doesn't take care of things, they go out and take care of them themselves. They have all the racial strife, but in spades. They really have it. Because people are all just jammed together in there and all kinds of things. So you can really see what happens in society if you were to speed up some of the things that are going on. So in that way, it's interesting to look at what goes on within a prison and to talk about the way they handle things, which is not very well. We don't handle them very well. I thought I'd tell you a little bit about prisons in general, if we can shift away from the ombudsman.
The only other thing I'd like to ask, do they get the notion of the general application of society and not just institutions?
We talked a little bit about that. Touched on the consumer ombudsman. Incidentally, I think that's where it really is going to be at in our company. I know in Minnesota, if everything keeps going, I'm helping with some legislation to push toward consumer ombudsman for state governmental services. And there'll be some other things happening with companies, like within Control Data. The first ombudsman I'm going to set up is for our employees. And then the next one is going to be for our customers. And I'm not sure which one's going to come first, because I'm getting a lot of complaints both ways right now. And we just announced the program 2 weeks ago. But I think many companies are going to be doing this as a way to protect themselves.
A lot of, you see this happening in newspapers and television stations.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great commercial thing now.
Right.
To have
Action Line or things like that.
Right.
Same idea. But they're really advocating. But they do go in and look at both sides, and sometimes they'll come back and say, the customer was wrong, the guy was right. You know, you really didn't have anything coming. Well, that's right.
It's really popular, too. It's surprising how many people are using it.
Right. There's a great need for it, I think. Sarah?
Yeah, I want to know about staff. What kinds of people are on the staff? Below the ombudsman.
Everybody says ombudsman, but it's ombudsman. I can't say it's Scandinavian.
Mediate anything? Do ombudsman? do all of them? I have a feeling that all the work is loaded on one guy or five people, and they have to do everything.
Well, the way it worked, here's how it operates. The ombudsman himself, there was one ombudsman, and then everybody else was a deputy ombudsman or a field investigator. He would get the cases. If they came in through the mail, half of them maybe came to us in written form. And he'd look at them and he'd say, that looks like one Connor can handle. He works well with this kind of a guy. And so he'd give it to me. He'd say, that's your case. And then it was up to me to follow it through to the end and write all the final conclusions and then give it back to him. And then he would say, okay, you go on out and solve it with the warden, or this looks like one I better handle. And then he'd go do it. He began to characterize people that for the kinds of cases that they could handle. Like, as I mentioned, the woman was great in handling complaints of sex offenders, male sex offenders. And now they really have problems, because within the prison society, they are just the scum of the earth. Nobody has anything to do with them, and they're really just, they get everything. I mean, prison for them is the worst experience of anyone that's in prison. Whereas murderers, who seem to do rather violent things too, they're relatively high echelon type of guy in the prison. In fact, the longer they're there, the more power they get within the prison. And then there's most of the people in between are drug users. And some people are very good at handling people that work with drugs. And that's one of the things I began to deal with. And I didn't realize that I could do that, but some of the first people I ran into were heavily into the drug scene, had lots of problems, and I could relate to them. And I got too far into that and almost didn't get out in time to go back to my own job. You can really get involved. It takes a lot of time. But normally that's what happens. Each person carries the whole thing through.
But then each field investigator had some research assistants?
No, they did it all themselves. Yeah. All we had were two clerk stenographers that would take all the stuff down. We carried around tape recorders, like this. We carried it around and mostly recorded that way rather than writing it down, because the most important thing to do is listen at first. You just have to learn to keep your mouth shut and really concentrate on what the person's saying. And And you know, talk about a Christian experience. I think the first experience I had, Sheriff, I never related this to you, I was being shown around the prison, and they decided that I ought to go back into the isolation area where the jail within the prison. And they have three or four levels of that, depending on how bad you've been. The outer level is layer is just you're locked in maybe five or six cells, and you get out three or four times a day to exercise, and the rest of the time you're locked in. Then it gets worse the worse you've been, until you get into isolation where you're locked up completely all the time, the door's closed, and you can't see anybody, and nobody can see you, or they can peep in through people. And those guys are really in bad shape. And so I was brought back to meet a couple of fellows who were in isolation. And I walked into this area, and the door was open. And I got close to the cell, and the guy reached out and grabbed my hand. I thought, oh my God, I've had it. The guy's going to get me as a hostage. You know, first day on the job. And I was just terrified. You know, the adrenaline was going all over. But I found out that he had, he was in there because he'd been up to the hospital and tried to steal some drugs. In fact, he had. He grabbed a guard and thrown him on the floor and grabbed some drugs and run. And he was out of his head when he was there anyway. He was really high. And when I got there, he'd been in the cell for 3 days, and he was really going through withdrawal. And he had to hang on to somebody. And he hung on to me, you know. He grasped me like this, and he hung on just as hard as he could. My hand was turning blue for about a half an hour. And after a while, we talked. He did all the talking. He relaxed, and his hand, you know, finally relaxed, and he let go. But he needed to hang on to somebody. And that surprised me. But then I found I constantly met people that said, you're the first guy I've talked to in a month that I've held a conversation with about anything other than what I'm supposed to do. So I found out that a lot of the time, and we have strategized around that, where we would just go around and talk to people and say, today is our day to go out and wander around and find out what's going on. No other purpose than just to let people talk to us and meet people from the outside. We came in at a bad time. Up until about 6 months ago, the prison was kind of open, and they were bringing in groups of people. You know, they had lots of clubs. They had what was the one we went to, Anne? They call it Cage. The environment Cage, yeah. That's an environmental club. They always pick real neat names. Yeah, they pick prison-type names. Cage was the environmental club. And they had the great rock band out there, Sounds Incarcerated, and things like that. They're really clever. They've got lots of time to think these things up. And they used to have lots of parties, and so they got to meet people from the outside, and one of the rehabilitative therapies was to expose them to people in a normal situation. And you know, most of the people in prison are pretty young, and they have no contact with women, so they bring their girlfriends in, and they all have a party. The one we went to was one of the first parties they'd had in prison. And they had just a ball. They had a great big gymnasium, and somebody had blown up one of these big plastic things, you know, about as high as the balcony. And you could walk inside these tunnels and wander around, and you could kind of see in. They weren't opaque, they were translucent.
Did you get lost?
I know, yeah, you could get lost. And the guards who were watching this, these inmates were taking their girlfriends in there, and the guards were going crazy trying to watch what was going inside because they're pretty straight. And so they were, but they didn't dare go in there either for some reason or another. And they just had a terrible evening trying to keep track of what was going on. They had a big, big banquet, and it was the first time they'd catered food in from the outside at all. And it was really great. And then they had a band. And they had a band from the outside and a band from the inside. One played, then the other, then they all got together, and they danced and danced, and you'd walk in, you wouldn't think it was any normal place. And yet, this happens very seldom anymore, and I think it has great therapeutic value, if not rehabilitated. At least it calms them down. They don't go doing crazy things while they're there. Yes, ma'am?
I know there's a
JCU
organization there. What about this?
They're very effective. I would guess, of all the organizations, they probably are the most effective because they deal again with a rather narrow population, but they all do, you know. But it's not so narrow. They're interested in business. They've done an awful lot of good and practical things. They'll find in their group of men, and the men that join the JCs in prison are full-fledged members of the JCs. They're not some lower order group. They really are JCs. They have chapter meetings. They tend to get out and go to national and conventions, and they escape from them quite often. That's one of the things that they join it for. They all have hidden agendas, but it's not, you know, you expect that kind of thing. That happened in Minnesota a year ago. But they really are effective in finding jobs, helping guys find themselves, finding jobs, and a lot of the people they treat get out and stay out, and that's the test of the program. Sir?
Is there a criteria to decide what a legitimate grievances?
Yes. Yes and no. There wasn't when I came, and that was why they had such a large caseload. Everybody would complain about anything. And we just experienced, for instance, a shakedown. Where a shakedown is where the prison officials decide that there's a lot of contraband in the cells. There's things that shouldn't be in there. Money, drugs, booze, you know, anything. Hardly anything you're supposed to have. And so they, once in a while, they'll just get everybody out of the cells, and the guards will go through and ruffle through everything. And at this time, the guards were angry about something, and they destroyed a lot of property. And there was a lot of evidence that they destroyed. We were around at the time. And it grew into a great big hassle, because inmates do have legal recourse to the courts to get the money back if something they have, and they can prove it, has been destroyed. Well, they destroyed, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 worth of property. And it looked like it would cost the state $50,000 to handle all the claims. So we said, why don't we come in, and we'll just get a list of all the claims, and if you agree that to take them as face value, pay them off, you know, we'll just get this thing over with. And so that was a legitimate grievance, and the warden agreed to do that, and it cost about $3,000 when we got all done instead of $50. So lots of times an ombudsman can save the taxpayer an awful lot of money too. I can think of lots of examples like that.
What is the warden still water, or who do you think of you?
Of me personally?
Of the principal, having someone come in. I haven't heard that he's very open to outside.
He's a strange man. An interesting man, not strange. At first he wouldn't talk to me at all. The first encounter I had with him is I went in his office with the ombudsman, and I didn't know what was going on. I was just there to kind of feel my way around, and they got into an argument. And I didn't realize they were in an argument at first, because it didn't seem to me like what they were talking about anyone would argue about. But geez, they both blew up. The warden blew up, his bad temper. And the ombudsman said, I don't want to talk to you when you're in that frame of mind. And the ombudsman took off, and I was back in the corner sitting there between the warden and the door. He turned and looked at me and said, I don't know what's going on. And I walked out the door, and so he followed us out. And he was just chewing away at us, and he said, I don't think I want you guys back here for a while, because, you know, until we can settle on what we're going to do. That was early in January, and we really had some bad feelings. About 2 weeks later, the ombudsman and I went up to St. Cloud, and we'd just gotten there, and we got a call from Stillwater and said, they tear gassed one of the deputy ombudsman. Well, they'd had kind of a riot around the custody office. Not a riot, just, you know, 100 guys gathered there and said they were mad because somebody had been locked up and they thought it was unjust. And it just happened that the deputy ombudsman was there and the warden wasn't. He was in St. Paul making a speech. And so one of the deputy wardens took over and really began to solve the problem. He worked with the deputy ombudsman. The two of them talked the inmates to go into the cell hall and said, you got to lock you all up and count you all to know that you're there and get you calmed down. And so they, about the time they started getting them into the cell hall, the warden showed up and he said, I'm going to teach you guys, you know, so we get in there now. And the deputy ombudsman said, can I go inside and help get the prisoners in their cells? He says, go on in. And so he went in and started walking down the cell hall. It's a long, long cell hall. And he started getting people in their cells. And he went around back behind, and the warden claims he forgot about him. And he ordered in the guys with the tear gas. They'd been out there for 20, 30 minutes. They came marching in, walked in the cell hall, and started shooting off tear gas shells. And just as this ombudsman came around the corner, an old tear gas shell came lopping at him and landed right, you know, within 5 feet of him. And I don't know if you've experienced tear gas, but it is really bad news. So he ducked into a cell and wrapped a towel around his head and stuck his head in the toilet. You know, that's what you do when you're being, if something's burning or if you got tear gas, you know, for some reason or other there's ventilation that comes up and you get fresh air. And finally a guard came down and got him out. Well, that got to be a big controversy because a group in St. Paul got all mad about it and they went to the legislature and said you had to have a hearing. And they had a hearing and the warden came and sat at the table with the ombudsman and they both told their stories and nothing was settled. They just went on. And then the there were a series of incidents, and then the warden decided to lock about 40 guys up without any due process. And he claimed that he wasn't doing that. So we had a long hassle about that. And that's when I decided that we better get into what you were talking about, Sarah, and that is, what is a grievance? And so I got looking at the situation and found out that there was no written material on what a grievance is and what the disciplinary procedure was. So I used some computer techniques. I went in and found all the information I could about discipline and then wrote it down and developed a flow chart, got the commissioner of corrections and the warden together with the ombudsman, and I said, here's what your disciplinary procedure looks like. Well, it was just a bunch of holes. They really didn't have one. And so what was obvious was that everybody was making up their own rules as they went along. And now you can't really be a very good judge or a mediator in a system that has no rules. And so then the next thing was to work hard at developing interim rules, which we did, and got the system set up. And now it's going quite well. Okay, any other questions about the ombudsman? I can't get to the prison yet. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Actually, on Wednesday, I'm going to show the community corrections thing, but it does talk about prison. And I have some slides that they use at Stillwater as an orientation for the inmates. And maybe I could show you those, to give you an idea of what a prison is like, and a little verbal description at the same time. I was surprised at the number of people that there are in prison. There are about 250,000 people in maximum security prisons all the time in this country. And there are about a million people in jails and prisons for some length of time. They're not just being held. They're there for a sentence, like the workhouse, the county jail. And then over a year's time, they estimate that over 3 million people end up in jail, if you include the town drunk and all that stuff. You know, of course, that won't happen so much now with our new detoxification centers. But even at that, you know, over 1% of our population during a year goes to jail or prison. That's a lot of people. That's a pretty good, healthy percentage. That's nowhere near the number of people that commit crimes. A lot of surveys indicate that almost everybody has done something during their lifetime, if they reach a majority, that's an incarcerable crime. If you write a bad check, or if you write a check without sufficient funds, you should go to prison for that. And I suppose most everybody around here has done that. I have, you know. I write the check and then quick payday, put it in when I was younger. I probably still do what my wife handles it. I don't know it anymore. But, you know, those kinds of things are incarcerable. If you're poor and get caught doing that, and you're in the wrong set of circumstances, you end up in jail. If you're a woman and do that, you're likely not to end up in jail. Society discriminates against men very heavily because in this area. Because men are in prisons and women doing the same things don't. There's some other things, though, that are looking like men have more serious genetic defects in the area of learning disabilities, and this is a whole other subject, but apparently learning disabilities leads to inability to read, leads to frustration, and it's the one and the only relationship between any background pattern and being a juvenile delinquent, and that's becoming more and more apparent. Women tend not to be very severe juvenile or learning disabled than men tend to be. And so maybe that's another reason why there are more men in prison.
We really see that here.
Yeah, I bet you do. You've got a lot of material on that.
We come in when our one constructed, and we come in with second grade reading abilities, and we raise them to ninth grade.
Well, there's some great stuff on that just happening now. The system is recognizing it. Like in St. Paul, they've got a program of remedial reading, which is oriented to people with learning disabilities, that really, I think, is going to be a great experiment. A fellow at the university just completed his PhD last year on this subject. A guy in New York did the same thing independently, came to the same conclusions, same kind of program, operating independently, and they just happened to bump into each other, you know, I guess. Maybe they haven't even yet. It's a very interesting concept. So we've talked about the object of the ombudsman, and I haven't told you much about the prison. If you're interested in that, we can talk about that next time. And I wouldn't mind putting on another session in between if you're really interested in that. There are all kinds of areas we could get into, like the way that discipline is handled within the prison. I can tell you about some specific cases that I had that are good examples. I guess the best example, which maybe I should tell you about him, because he's a man that worked for me for a long time, who has almost everything that could go wrong went wrong with him. He has a black cloud over his head. And I ran into him through a friend of mine who was our public relations director. When our public relations director's son was killed in Vietnam, he had an employee working for him that went to prison for writing bad checks. And he went down in grand style. He wrote over $100,000 for the grand checks, bad checks, and he was on heroin at the same time doing some real dandy things. And so he went down in style. And so the public relations director decided to become what we call his amicus. In Minnesota, we have a program where you find a friend. I guess that means friend, right? For each inmate. And this grew out of the judicial system. some judges that got that going. And so he decided to become a friend and adopt this guy, even though the guy was almost as old as he was. He was about 40-some years old. And after he had been in prison for 18 months, he was getting out, he asked me if I would have this man work for me. The man had been trained to be a psychological clerk, and I have a psychologist working for me. So we went out and visited him, and sure enough, we thought we'd hire him, and we brought him on. He worked for one full year, from the 1st of January, 72, to the 1st of January, 73, without many problems. He had, we did a lot of things wrong. We decided to make him a case study, and he was taking care of it himself. He was the case study, he was writing it himself, and we'd help him, so that we could determine the problems involved in bringing a person like himself back into the world of work and into society. We did a lot of things wrong, and there was a lot of bad luck. The first thing we did was not help him buy his car. He bought a car, and he really got taken. And they sold it for about $2,000. He bought about a $100 car. It kept falling apart, and he had a hard time getting to work. And that was a great source of problem. His wife got sick. She worked, too, and it was a good portion of their income. But the two of them made a very good income together. And he did a tremendous job. For 12 months, he really did his job. And that's all we were worried about, really. Another thing, though, we did not do was to provide him with financial assistance, financial guidance. And that you have to start with the guy when he comes into prison from the day he walks in the door. You start with him helping him get his family act together, making sure that he understands his finances, keeping his books. These guys have been poor, and they just don't know how to keep books. Their own personal records, except they can write some dandy bad checks, but they don't keep track of, they don't fill out the stub. And that's part of the problem. And there's a whole bunch of rehabilitative services that I began to identify that a lot of people have already known about. I couldn't find them. That's another part of the problem. When you need help, you can't find it very well in the community. But in January, he ran into a series of bad luck. His wife was run over by a car, and so he did, and he had lots of problems. His son got kicked out of school, an 8-year-old kid, and the school system was miserable in dealing with it, and he lost a lot of work. And his older son had been murdered. And this gives you a little bit about a background the guy came from. His older son, by her first marriage, was murdered 3 or 4 years ago in a bar fight, and the trial came around, and he just couldn't face this thing. His car broke down again, a bunch of other stuff, and he just folded. He just went like that. I saw him, he kept trying to stay with it, and he kept fading out, and he went on drugs. He first went on cocaine, and they started taking hard heroin. And this was in January. And that's when I became an ombudsman. So I decided that since he was on parole, I'd become his ombudsman. I'd shift roles. I really hadn't dealt with him directly as a boss, but I thought I'd shift roles and become his ombudsman and learn what it would take to try to get this guy straightened up. So I went to his parole officer, and they said, "Oh, we got out some great programs. We'll really help you out." And so I kept calling them, and they kept promising to help me out, but I never saw them, and I finally quit and started checking around the community myself and found a drug treatment program for ex-offenders that was just perfect. They handled him, his problem, his wife's problem. By that time, she was out of food by the day we got there, and they went out and got her some groceries, his son was still working, I guess, but got their family situation straightened out, got him some family counseling, got him on a methadone program, and got him into counseling, into group therapy. And Ann and I went to the first group therapy session, and we kind of celebrated, took him out for dinner, went over to the therapy session, sat through it, and he was really bragging about how great it was to get straightened out again, and he was back on the right track, and he'd gotten off, but wow, he was going to come back. And the next day he was to come back, and I haven't seen him since. He disappeared again, and he's just kind of given up. And that really brings me to one of the two or three major conclusions that I've come to out of the system. One is that right now there are no real rehabilitatable programs that are in action. And a lot of them in little small research groups. You know, people say, yeah, we've got something that will really correct people, and it works well, and they've got nice, neat, tight research projects. But there are a few of those, and hardly any research is being done on this area. So as taxpayers, we're not getting very much for our money. We spend an awful lot of money on criminal justice. Most of it goes to police departments for new equipment. And this is part of the problem. The police need that new equipment to hold the guys down that are out doing bizarre things that are protecting us. You know, they've got to have it. Not in all cases, but they do need it. They've got terrible problems too. But that money is being spent, and still no money is being spent on the front end new programs to prevent people from getting into situations where the police have to handle them. And we really haven't, in the last 10 or 15 years, spent much money on how to correct people. So right now what we do is put them into institutions that make them worse than they were before they went in. In fact, substantially worse. And that's not just a statement anymore, or kind of an off-the-cuff statement. That's a proven fact. Research now has indicated this beyond a shadow of a doubt, that everybody that goes into a prison is much worse off. The point where judges are saying, I'd rather that people don't get caught because I have to put them in prison, and when they come out, they're much, much worse. 97% of the people that go into prison come out again. And so if you've been a victim of a crime of some sort, and we want to punish the guy by sending him to prison, we really punish ourselves because that guy's going to come back out and do it again, except maybe twice as much and twice as hard. Well, that's the bell. I didn't realize it would go that fast.
Well, what's help? That's the other 2 points. Well, who's next up? And look at it.
Henny.
Well, Henny will be coming in here, dear. Well, one more. Give us the other point. He isn't here yet.
Let me see. What was my 3rd point? There's a lot of things that you can do. I become very cynical about the whole thing, and yet there are a whole series of things that can be done. I think the most important thing is to get people aware of the problem so that they can get push their legislators. And there's a whole series of things that I can talk about. Maybe I should do that tomorrow, or Wednesday, I mean. I can talk about that tomorrow.
They kicked, when Yarlett Arfalden was in there, they had the institution, they kicked him out on his whole critique of the prison stuff,
Yes.
And the county editors did it. I remember reading it. A lot of these county newspapers, wasting taxpayers' money, thinking of sending them to prison to give them a free ride.
Yep.
Right. And the public mind at that time was still opposed to remedial attention of the prison. So how is it now?
It's still the same way. No change.
It's even worse, isn't it? You get with Fogo, and he had all these petitions coming up out of St. Cloud. On one hand, they're criticizing what's going on, and yet St. Cloud wants to hold that reformatory open because of its employment there. But then they've got a petition out to fire Fogo. I saw one down in Faribault too, at the gas station.
Yeah, he finally was removed.
He removed or resigned.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, went to Illinois. And he wasn't.
He's an interesting character. We can talk about him for a long time. He did his job. He was brought in to spearhead some new ideas. And he was so abrasive that the man that took his place was a relief, and yet he is more rehabilitated than Fogel was. So it's a beautiful situation.
Yeah, but you needed somebody like Fogel
to get it going. Yeah. And I'm serving on the committee that's looking at that whole situation now. That's one of the things that I got stuck with as a result of my experience, working on the what to do about all the institutions and how to gradually shut them down and work into new areas, which is really very interesting.
Well, we'll have a chance to hear more about that. Then.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh man, beautiful place.
And we believe that if you and your parishes get going to something similar, Holden Village in these urban areas, in a communal living situation, you can take one or two of these people continually into your community, and you will have a fantastic experience.
Well, the Lutherans are well into this through the Lutheran Social Service. Yeah. I can tell you a little bit about their halfway house. This is about the best there is.
It really works. On that side, we have no regrets here whatsoever. Well, Mike was just here and baptized his baby. He's on the government's commission now for parole and parole rehabilitation.